Hello, it's John Dennis on Wednesday, the 14th of January. Today, Britons are among the gloomiest in the world when asked about their hopes for the economy, according to a Guardian poll.
British come out as pretty gloomy. Maybe that's just what it is to be British, even in the good times, perhaps. If we'd done a poll like this, we wouldn't have been top of the table as the most optimistic nation.
The Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and the US President George Bush offer different accounts of what led America to abstain on last week's UN Security Council vote on a ceasefire in Gaza.
Condoleezza Rice seemed embarrassed and being left sort of high and dry by the White House intervention.
And Philip Norman, the biographer of John Lennon and the Beatles, on Ringo Starr's refusal to sign any more autographs.
The one great thing in his life, the one stroke of luck, was becoming a Beatle and not very much talent. He was just around at the right moment.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with the news headlines and a look at the papers.
There's been more serious fighting in Gaza as the Israeli army pushes further into the enclave. The Israelis say they've been bombing tunnels used by the population to smuggle in arms and food. Palestinian hospital officials say more than 900 Gazans have been killed since the Israeli attack began 3 weeks ago. It's claimed that half the dead are civilians. An Israeli helicopter pilot last night said he was sorry for civilian casualties and had aborted missions to avoid them. The UN Secretary-General is on his way to Egypt try to negotiate a ceasefire. He'll meet the president and then visit Israel and the Palestinian West Bank. He told reporters the fighting must stop because too many people have died. The British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has urged Israel to respond to the UN Security Council call for an immediate ceasefire. Brown will also speak to the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas today. The Prime Minister himself travels to Europe. He's visiting France today and Germany on Thursday. Brown is trying to secure an international agreement on measures to combat the world economic crisis. Yesterday, he spoke to the head of the US Federal Reserve. Today, he'll meet President Nicolas Sarkozy of France. On Thursday, he'll discuss the situation with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Germany announced a financial stimulus package of their own this week. Gas supplies from Russia into Europe were halted again hours after they resumed. Eastern European countries like Bulgaria have no supplies whatsoever. The Russian gas company claimed Ukraine blocked the supplies, while the Ukrainians claimed the Russians had sent the gas through the wrong pipes to ensure the gas would be switched off to parts of their own country. In spite of the recession, it seems Britain's become the world's biggest wine importer. The industry organisation Vinexpo says that Britain imports more wine even than the USA, but the French and Italians actually drink more than we do. There are various stories about the economy on the front pages of the morning papers. The Telegraph and The Guardian report on the government announcement due today that it'll take a stake in failing companies if it has to underwrite their bank loans. The Financial Times tells us that Barclays are having to cut 2,100 jobs and that the bank Citigroup is going to break itself up to separate its risky finance and security business from the more standard banking. The Times reports that councils are now starting to cut jobs in their thousands, it says. 40 councils approached by the paper said they were shedding jobs. Meanwhile, a Guardian opinion poll shows that Britain's economic confidence has been shattered by the crisis. People are now less likely to trust banks, the stock market, or government handling of the economy. We'll bring you the full story shortly. Otherwise, The Guardian also reports Israel may face a UN court over its invasion of Gaza. There are growing calls for intervention by international courts on human rights and criminal grounds. The paper says the UN General Assembly will discuss the issue this week. Finally, The Independent says there's an investigation been started because it's been revealed two members of the Immigration Service were members of the BNP. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
A series of opinion polls have been carried out around the world, in Britain by ICM for The Guardian, aiming to gauge public confidence on the economy. Here in the UK, we're the most pessimistic, we have the least faith in our government to sort things out, and as for the banks, even in Iceland they have more faith in them. With the details is The Guardian's chief leader writer, Julian Glover.
This was a series of polls carried out at the same time in countries around the world. So it took part in the G8 countries, the big economies, America, Britain, Germany, France, places like that. took place in some of the developing countries. We've got Brazil, Russia, India, China, places with the kind of fastest economic growth in recent years, and also some of the smaller countries like Iceland and Austria that have also been hit by the financial crisis. And it was carried out by polling companies in each of those countries with expertise locally, slightly different samples, slightly different methodologies, but still gives us a really good comparative set of data about what people feel the credit crunch is doing for them.
How do British people compare with those in other countries?
British come out as pretty gloomy. Maybe that's just what it is to be British, even in the good times, perhaps. If we'd done a poll like this, we wouldn't have been top of the table as the most optimistic nation. But where Americans are pretty positive, despite the difficulties about the possibilities of economic recovery and about banks and about the stock market and about their own financial circumstances, and certainly places like China, people are really quite optimistic and they do trust the government there. Perhaps that's just a sort of legacy of the kind of politics they have in China. In Britain, they don't. Trust is really low in most of the institutions and in the government. We're right down near the bottom, sort of 3 to 4 out of 10.
Do we draw the conclusion from that, though, that it's because our government isn't to be trusted, or is it just, as you indicated earlier, possibly a cultural peculiarity to Britain?
Well, it might be a bit of both. I think what it does, first of all, show is that people in Britain really have been hit by this, and they are frightened by it. And in a way, they're more frightened than other countries. The claim that Britain, as the Prime Minister sometimes said, is well-placed to come out of this recovery. Other countries are almost in a worse position. The population just don't agree with that. They're really, really anxious. Some areas, trust is absolutely at rock bottom. It might also show it's just a bigger effect here, that places like China, a lot of people haven't really felt the effects yet. That probably is changing quite fast, but not so far.
Incredible, though, Julian, that when people were asked whether they trust the banks, people were more likely to trust the banks in Iceland than they were in Britain.
Well, maybe that's just Icelanders being patriotic. They feel so dismayed by their banking crisis. I think trust in banks in Britain is really terrible now, and it's something that's happened quite fast. People now know that big banks like Lloyds, TSB, the government's had to put lots of money in. It's not just sort of troubled societies like Bradford and Bingley and Northern Rock, which started the credit crunch. And I think people don't trust banks for their money, but it also shows they don't trust the stock market and they don't trust the government really to make it better.
Trust in the stock market wasn't perhaps quite as low as one might expect.
No, and also trust in the housing market. We asked around the world, do you think this is a good time or a bad time to buy a house? Britain came middle of the table on that, maybe because culturally we like buying houses. That's sort of what you do if you're British. Some other places less keen on buying a house. People aren't so sure of a house as an investment. But I wonder now, property prices are falling and banks are in trouble and there's not much interest around. People might begin to see houses as a source of investment rather than something to sell.
And which places in the world are the most optimistic and forward-looking in that respect?
Certainly in this poll, the economies that I think people in the city like to call BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India and China, particularly India and China, are really quite positive. They're the only ones who come out overall as optimistic, although there's anxiety there too. And of course, we have to put in a bit of qualification for the nature of polling in those companies. But the companies that did it are proper companies. I think people there have got used to economic growth. They feel quite positive about the future. In Britain, we're just anxious.
Julian Glover, and there's full details of that poll today at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website, design critic Jonathan Glancy suggests 10 alternatives for the design classic stamps that have just been issued by the Royal Mail at guardian.co.uk/art. Is David Bowie to blame for the global financial crisis? Find out why he might be by reading what John Harris has to say at guardian.co.uk/music. And Patrick Barkham interviews residents around Heathrow whose lives are overshadowed by the proposed runway at guardian.co.uk/business. Last week, the United States abstained on a UN Security Council vote calling for an end to the violence in Gaza. The Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, has bragged how he persuaded the US President to change course, embarrassing Condoleezza Rice in the process. But the White House has offered a different version of events. Ewan McCaskill's our Washington correspondent.
Late on, I think it was Thursday night, they reached an agreement, and the resolution was to call for an immediate ceasefire. And at one point, it looked as if all the UN Security Council members, including the US, were signed up for that. But then at the last minute, there was a surprise when the Americans pulled out and abstained rather than voted for it. So there was a sort of vote of 14-4 and one abstention. And that weakened the resolution. And there's an argument that because of that, then the Israelis and Hamas were able to basically ignore it.
Was the effect of the US abstention the continued conflict in Gaza?
Well, you could argue that. If the US had been on board, then it would have been, I think, probably harder for Israel to continue. Maybe they would have continued anyway, but it would have been that bit much harder. By abstaining, it was effectively giving Israel a green light to continue.
Now, it seems that Condoleezza Rice, the US Secretary of State, received a last-minute phone call from George Bush. What was the series of events that led the United States to come to the decision that it was going to abstain from this vote?
Well, there's two conflicting versions, and this is embarrassing both for the White House and the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, because they're giving different accounts of it. Olmert, a meeting on Monday night, speaking in Hebrew, so maybe thought it wouldn't be picked up, or maybe thought it was a small event, nobody would notice. But for whatever reason, he claimed that worried about this resolution. He phoned George Bush, who was making a speech in Philadelphia, pulled him off the podium 10 minutes before the vote was due to take place and says, "You can't do this." Bush says he didn't know anything about it, hadn't read the resolution, hadn't heard about it. And Olmert says, "Well, I have, and you have to pull it." And that's what happened. They abstained. The White House is now sort of disputing this and saying it's inaccurate. Either Olmert isn't telling the truth or the White House isn't telling the truth. Diplomats from other countries in the Security Council certainly seemed to uphold the Olmert version last Friday when they were sort of raking over the ashes of what had gone wrong. They seemed to support this version that Condoleezza Rice seemed embarrassed and being left sort of high and dry by the White House intervention.
Ewan McCaskill in Washington. My name's John Dennis. Still to come, Britain has become the world's biggest wine importer. We talk to Malcolm Gluck.
My first reaction is to open a bottle of wine and say, "Oh my God, it's yet another set of statistics."
But first, masterpieces from one of the greatest art galleries in the world, the Prado in Madrid, can now be viewed by anyone with access to the internet. The high-resolution Google Earth images allow 14 works of art by masters such as Goya, Velázquez, El Greco, Rembrandt and Titian to be seen in the finest detail. Jonathan Jones, our art critic, explains how it works.
If you download the appropriate stuff from Google Earth, and you can then home in from space, as it were, into the Prado, you get a 3D Prado, then you can go into the Prado virtually and actually go to these 14 masterpieces, go onto them and explore them in great detail, probably in greater detail than any museum has offered online before in terms of just the scale of the image and the resolution of it.
Did it work for you?
Yeah. I mean, these things are always, you're dealing with what your computer can do and can't do, and it's very unpredictable, these kinds of things. I had a crash after a while because I was looking at Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights very, very, very close up and moving too fast, and in the end it crashed. So, you have to start again. But anybody who uses the internet knows that, is familiar with all of that. It's nothing's quite as perfect as it's supposed to be. I mean, it's quite exciting in terms of the scale of image it's offering. I mean, if this technology developed, if you ended up with museums offering online images of great paintings at this level of detail. In some ways, the Prado is behind other museums. The National Gallery in London or the Museum of Modern Art in New York offer pretty much their whole collection online, and you can look at it, but not in this degree of resolution. What's special about this is that it is true. I was a bit sceptical, actually, because, as I say, you can do it. You can look at, National Gallery paintings online anyway. But what's unusual is I was able to focus so closely on the Garden of Earthly Delights, for example, that I ended up, I was just looking at cracks in the end. I was looking at the cracks in the surface.
Because the level of detail that this form of viewing allows is, so close, it's closer than you'd be able to get to it if you were actually there in person. Does that mean that these works are actually best viewed using Google Earth in this way? Or is it really still no substitute for being there in the flesh, as it were?
There's never any substitute for being there in the flesh. It's the physical fact of a painting, the scale of it. For example, scale, yes, you can look at these paintings in huge magnification, but then you don't actually know how big the original is, in a sense. You know, when whatever form you look at a reproduction in, whether it's in this form or in a book or whatever, you know, any time that I've ever sort of, say, written about a picture in reproduction or, thought, you know, known it perhaps for a long time in reproduction, you see the original, and it's a totally different fact. You know, I mean, the original is always, it's a different thing from any reproduction. Colours are never quite the same in any reproduction, digital or in a book, or, you know, the texture, the, you know, how, what the frame looks like, the weight of it, even the smell, in a sense. There's a physicality and just the way light hits a painting. I mean, a reproduction, if you're looking at something on screen, the light always hits it in the same way because the light is provided by the screen, as it were. If you look at a painting in a gallery, of course, it's always affected by how it's lit.
Jonathan Jones. The world's biggest importer of wine is now Britain. We imported 1.6 billion bottles in 2007. That's according to research by the industry body Vinexpo. The top five suppliers to the UK in order are Australia, France, the United States, Italy and Spain. Wine critic Malcolm Gluck gives his reaction.
Since I ever became a professional wine writer 20 years ago, the figures have gone up and up. We drink more. We drink better in the sense that I think the wine we drink nowadays is much better made than it was 30, 40 years ago. There's a lot of rot gut around. Having said that, I'm not particularly surprised by the latest figures because I think in spite of anything to do with a credit crunch or a slump or whatever you like to call it, we Brits enjoy wine. We've stopped being a so-called beer island. We're now a wine island.
Why should Australian wines be especially popular in Britain?
New World wine, particularly Australian, became very popular for several reasons. The first, and I don't think there's a precedence of reason here. There's several, and all together they make a very potent mix. Firstly, I think that Australian wines had Anglophone names. So you didn't need to speak Spanish, French, Italian or German or anything. There was nothing complicated about an Australian wine. It was called what it was. It was called Wollongong or it was called Cape Bondi Beach or whatever it was called. So we understood it, first of all. Secondly, it used the name of a grape variety. It didn't have anything fancy about it. Thirdly, the wine was generally much more open, friendly, fruity. Fourthly, the wines in general, reds as well as whites, and in rosés and sparkling wines, went very well with the increasingly spicy ethnic foods that we Brits were beginning to turn to. So all that vast abundance of so-called ethnic foods from the Middle East, Far East, Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Indonesian, Chinese, Japanese, you name it, Australian wines went very well with. Lastly, of course, you add the fact that for many years, Australian wines were very affordable. That is a pretty strong bunch of reasons to stay loyal to a country for its wines.
Another interesting aspect of this report, Malcolm, is that consumption of rosé is expected to increase between now and 2012.
Yes, I think it's very interesting that this is one of those things which none of us could have forecast. No, as far as I know, certainly no guru or commentator or wine critic has ever suggested that rosé would take off. Part of it, the only reason I can think this has happened, it'd be interesting to see whether over this past winter, or the winter we're still in fact, because of the unusually cold winter we've enjoyed, whether rosé sales would go down. Because one of the things that kept rosé sales buoyant was they were year-round. It wasn't just a summer drink. You know, people would go out to the barbie in summer, July, August, whatever, weather warm. Yeah, let's have a rosé. One could see that there was a ready association of climate with product choice. But we seem to have a climate which is more equable all year round. So I always thought, well, maybe that's the reason that people liked rosé. But part of it was also, I think, that the wine trade was unusually quick to respond to people's tastes, and there's a whole range of rosés which are, I guess they're just more interesting than rosés used to be.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
Philip Norman is one of the world's chief authorities on the Beatles. His recent book, John Lennon, The Life, has already been hailed as the definitive biography of the late ex-Beatle. And Norman's earlier work, Shout, The True Story of the Beatles, has long been regarded as the best book on the group yet written. In an interview at Norman's London home, I asked him how he thought the Beatles' recorded work had been managed since John Lennon's death.
For a long, long time, they were very, very well managed because, you know, the person in charge of Apple was Neil Aspinall, who was their close friend and the Beatles' close friend and their roadie, and, you know, the person who never sold them out was always loyal. I don't know what's going to happen now. Neil Aspinall left Apple and, of course, unfortunately died last year. So who knows? But, it has not been sort of bastardized to this point. That's all one can say.
Paul McCartney recently raised the prospect that Carnival of Light, which was a 15-minute recording, experimental recording they made in early 1967, might be commercially released. What's your view of that?
Well, everything is going to be commercially released, you know, over the years. They left such a huge amount of marvellous stuff behind in a very short career. Of course it will come out, yes, and it will be picked over by scholars, and of course it will be treated with tremendous reverence, where at the time they would have said, oh, the Beatles are going potty.
Ringo Starr recently said that he wasn't going to sign any more autographs. What do you make of that? I was interested that Paul McCartney sprang to his defence.
Interesting that Paul sprang to Ringo's defence, because they don't really get on anymore, the two of them. I think it was very stupid of Ringo. He's a very graceless character these days. He was always the one who had the sort of charm and knew what to say. You know, the one great thing in his life, the one stroke of luck, was becoming a Beatle and not very much talent. He was just around at the right moment. And now to sort of do that, make those silly sort of automatic peace signs and say, I'm not, you know, really sort of sod off to the fans, I think is stupid.
And Beatles always in the headlines, of course. And a Vatican newspaper at the end of last year said it was forgiving John Lennon for his remark in 1966 that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus. I thought that was extraordinary. What did you think?
It was extraordinary because when John made the remark, the Vatican did not condemn him. There was no fatwa from the Catholic Church on John Lennon at all. There was a mild sort of reproof in a Vatican newspaper at the time. The real religious backlash against that was in America and wasn't at all in, you know, from Rome. So I can't think why this ceremonial forgiveness had to be announced.
Philip Norman, and you can listen to a longer version of that interview focusing on the life of John Lennon at guardian.co.uk/audio. And Philip's book, John Lennon, The Life, is published by HarperCollins. Generation Kill is the new television series from David Simon and Ed Burns, the makers of The Wire. It swaps the streets of Baltimore for the battlefields of Iraq. Ed Burns is a former Vietnam veteran. Our TV critic Sam Wollaston asked him about his service in Vietnam.
I was in Vietnam for a year as an infantryman, so I have that sort of universal experience of combat. That's sort of the mirror that I used in doing Generation Kill, just if it felt authentic to me, even though I've never experienced something like, you know, using these type of weapons and stuff, then it was something that would resonate and something to go with. So, you know, that... And just being in situations where, you know, you're challenged. Men sort of always do the same thing, you know. What happens is that, you know, we always talk about the macho-ness, but it's just the opposite. It's the feminine side that comes up in combat. So when reading the book and then crafting the miniseries, it was looking for that aspect of the characters becoming characters, rather than becoming stereotypes. That was the way I sort of saw this project.
Tell me a little bit about your own experiences in Vietnam. Did you see combat?
Yeah, I saw a year of combat.
A year of combat?
Yes.
How would that kind of compare to what these guys have are going through?
The disconnect between each level of command is the same. When you're in that, all that, that world of the first Humvee is very restricted. And in the fields in the jungles of Vietnam, that little squad was all you had. And that's all you knew. You didn't have any clear idea what you were doing or why you were doing it.
But you mean the bigger picture?
The bigger picture was completely outside your scope. And in that sense, it becomes all about surviving with your team,
yeah,
with your group of guys. Everything collapses in. And every time you're told to do something, from your perspective, it's stupid because you're not seeing anything beyond what you know. So if they're telling you to go this way and you look at the terrain and you can see, Christ, it's, you know, ambush alley, or it's, you know, full of mines, you don't think it's a very good idea. Maybe somebody in that helicopter might think it's a good idea, but you don't think it's a good idea. So in that sense, you know, you become very cynical, very jaded. Have to be very much in control of who you are, because the trick is to get out of there in one piece.
Did you kill people in Vietnam?
I did.
How was that?
Killing is it's almost fair. It's what warfare actually should be, in the sense that they're shooting at you, you're shooting at them. Where it breaks down and becomes a different type of thing is when it goes more into a police-type action, where the enemy is a bomb or an IED or a mine, and you're stepping on it or it's blowing you up, and you can't retaliate. When that starts to happen, then the anger in the unit starts to build. And God help anybody who steps in front of that anger.
Ed Burns. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.